Well, good morning and welcome. It's good to see everybody here today. We have several visitors with us. We're glad you're here today. I encourage you to pick up your Bible and read with us in Matthew chapter 24. Got a lot of verses to read, a lot of comments to make, and we'll just jump right to the text. Matthew chapter 24, starting in verse 1. Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. And he said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another, which will not be torn down." And as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "See to it that no one misleads you, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will mislead many. You will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not frightened, for those things must take place, but that is not yet the end. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. But all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. Then they will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations because of my name. At that time many will fall away and will betray one another and hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. Because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Whoever is on the housetop must not go down to get the things out that are in his house. Whoever is in the field must not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. But pray that your flight will not be in the winter or on a Sabbath. For then there will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. Unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, 'Behold, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you in advance. So if they say to you, 'Behold, he is in the wilderness,' do not go out. Or, 'Behold, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe them. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures or the eagles will gather. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." A lot of stuff going on in that passage, a lot of confusion in the religious world. We're going to try to clear up some of that confusion this morning, some things that are troubling just from that very passage of Scripture. Now, I have a question for you to start with. Have you ever been behind a car with one of those bumper stickers on it that said, "In case of rapture, this car will be unoccupied"? You remember those stickers? I haven't seen those in quite a few years, but the implication is that when Christ returns, he'll rapture that driver up to heaven. And that car is just going to be out of control, so you really got to be careful. That's what the warning is. And look, if you can see that out of control car, that means that you have been left behind. You have been left behind to unparalleled tribulation. As a matter of fact, it's referred to by most people in the religious world as the Great Tribulation. And from Matthew chapter 24 and from other really cryptic verses in the Bible, extravagant doctrines have been piecemealed together. And they teach things like, during this great tribulation, the Antichrist is going to rule over the earth. And he's just going to do despicable things to those people who are left behind. And they're going to have to receive the mark of the beast, the number 666, engraved or tattooed on the palms of their hands or on their scalps, Some people will even go as far as to say that means you're going to have computer chips inserted into your brain, microchips implanted there. And if you don't worship this Antichrist, you're going to be tortured. And it's even going to be worse than that. That people will go to Revelation, the book of Revelation, chapters 6 through 8, talks about how there's going to be great famine on earth. There's going to be fire and hailstones pelting the earth from the sky. And there's going to be the greatest earthquake that ever happened on the face of the earth. And then in chapter 16 of Revelation, it talks about the seven bowls of God's wrath and how there's just going to be malignant sores over people's bodies, and seas and the rivers are going to turn to blood, and on and on and on. It's just going to be terrible. It's going to be awful. It's going to be so horrible. It's really going to be just a little bit of a taste of hell on earth. And Jesus said there in Matthew chapter 24 that this generation shall not pass. And people believe that's talking about our generation, when the sun and the moon will be darkened and the stars are going to fall from the sky and one's going to be left and another's going to be taken. Wow, it's just incredible. It's really unbelievable what a lot of people teach about the end time events. Well, should we believe it? Should we buy into what a lot of people in the religious world teach is true? Is this the plain and simple truth that the Bible teaches about what's going to happen when Jesus comes back? If it's truth, it's certainly not the plain and simple truth. It's scintillating, it's sensational, it's fantastic, but it's controversial, it's convoluted, it's confusing. How can you know the truth? How can we understand passages like this one that we just read that's so cryptic, that's so arcane, that's so difficult to get a handle on? Passages like Matthew chapter 24. Let's play a game together and see if we can come to a better understanding of language and writing styles and the way things are said and spoken and understood among people. Let's pretend like we're at a Veterans Day celebration and people of all ages are there having a big old time. It's beautiful outside, sun is shining and not a cloud in the sky, and this guy steps up to the microphone out in the open field and he says something in reference to somebody storming the beaches. What images come to your mind personally when I say that term, storming the beaches? Now, if you're just a young kid, you might think that there is a big storm over the ocean, maybe lightning and thunder and hail and rain, and that's just a bad place to be. And maybe, I don't know, if you're 20-something, you might think about Daytona Beach, spring break, the kids storming the beaches, they're hitting the beaches at high tide to enjoy the surf and the fun. Or if you are an older person, you might recognize that language, that it's talking about the pivotal Allied offensive on the beaches of Normandy, France during World War II. So according to what generation you're from, that idea of storming the beaches is going to mean different things to you. What if I say the Battle of the Bulge? What images do you conjure up in your mind? Some of you are looking at me like I have three heads right now. You have no idea what the Battle of the Bulge is. Some of you, maybe you're 30 or 40 years old, middle age, and yeah, Rick's looking right down at his belly. Is that what you're doing there? The Battle of the Bulge? Maybe fighting that waistline, the battle with keeping your weight under control? But once again, folks from the older generations, they understand that that was another battle, another key battle during World War II. And D-Day, the same kind of thing. And here's the point about this game we're playing. The people of the generation who lived during that time and closest to that time, they know the language, don't they? They understand what is being talked about. Well, when most people read the prophetic language, like we just read, like that idea of coming on the clouds of heaven, and the sun being darkened and the moon being turned to blood, we get all kind of images in our mind. We envision all types of different gruesome things. But when Jesus used this imagery to the crowd that he spoke to, when he stood there that day, or actually when he sat there on the Mount of Olives, the Jews of that time, they were familiar with this kind of language, with this terminology. They understood it clearly. They read this kind of thing all the time. They read the Old Testament. They were very familiar with this type of imagery. It was no big mystery to them. They understood that God used this type of language to prophesy the destruction of nations during different times in history. I'll give you a couple examples. In Isaiah chapter 19 and verse 1, we read there, "The oracle concerning Egypt. Behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is about to come to Egypt. The idols of Egypt will tremble at his presence, and the heart of the Egyptians will melt within them. God was going to punish the Egyptian nation, the nation of Egypt, for their evil practices, the way they dealt treacherously with God's people. And the depiction is he was coming in the clouds. And then in Isaiah 13 and verse 10, for the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light, and the sun will be darkened when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. And that's a reference to God's destruction of Babylon. So, we understand that this type of language has a meaning, has a certain significance, the destruction of certain nations. So, in Matthew chapter 24, before we jump to that conclusion, that what is being referenced here is the end of the world and Christ coming to judge the world and to destroy everything in it, we need not be too hasty to make that conclusion. Instead, we need to consider the writing style and understand that this is talking about the destruction of a particular nation. Two other things we need to take into consideration when we read passages like this, when we read any passages, really, of the Bible, is the historical context and the literary context. Now let's look at the literary context first. What exactly is going on in the text? Bring you up to speed a little bit. Jesus and his disciples were walking around the temple complex. And the disciples, they pointed out the beauty and the splendor of that temple and the surrounding structures. Just enormous stones were used to construct this temple. Magnificent stones to make this structure. And Jesus said, not one stone is going to be left upon another. He said that in verse 2. And in verse 3, in private, after they had left the temple, they had walked just a short distance to the Mount of Olives. That's when the apostles, when his disciples, asked Jesus two questions. It may look like three questions in verse 3, but it's actually only two. Question number 1, when will these things happen? And question number 2 is, what will be the sign of the coming of the end of the age? Once again, note, in Mark 13 and verse 4, and in Luke 21 and verse 7, a parallel account, the question is simply, when will these things happen, and what will the sign be? A lot of people think there's three questions. When will these things happen? What will be the sign of that? And what will be the sign of the end of the age? But that last section is just one question. What will be the sign of the coming of the end of the age? Note again, we're not talking about the end of the world here. We're not just talking about the destruction of the whole world, but the end of the age. That word age is the Greek word einos. It's where we get the word eon. And it can mean in the existing or current age. It's not the end of the world that we're talking about here, but the destruction of the temple. Remember Jesus said, not one stone will be left upon another of this structure, of this temple. Now this would surely mark the end of the world that they knew and that they lived in, would it not? The historical context tells us that everything that these listeners did in this government, in this economy, in this religion, it just revolved around the temple. The temple was the holy place. It was God's house. There were sacrifices burned there continually, night and day. This was the center of the holy city, Jerusalem. It was the center of Judea. And now Christ tells them, it's all going to be destroyed. It's all going to be reduced to rubble. It's just going to be one big scrap heap. And as you can imagine, this upset them greatly. And they wanted to know when this was going to happen. And they wanted to know if there was a sign that was going to indicate when this was going to happen. And Christ was just speaking to a time of momentous change, great upheaval. Their entire way of life was just going to change. The end of the age indeed was coming. The end of the age of Israel. The end of their economy. The end of their religion. The end of their nation. So Christ answers these questions that they ask of him. And he answers the second question first. What would be the sign of the coming of the end of the age? Now I want you to notice, as we read verses 4 through 8, we won't read them again, but notice what the sign will not be. It talks about wars and rumors of wars and famines and earthquakes. And Jesus said, this is not the end. Don't worry about that. This is the beginning of birth pains. This is not the sign. You turn on your TV to a religious station and you see this guy sitting there at this news broadcast desk. And there's this map of the world up and it has these pinpoints of Afghanistan and Iran and all of the wars that are going on around the world. And it'll have pinpoints where places where there were great earthquakes and typhoons and what have you. And what do they say about that? These are the signs of the time. This is the indication that the end is growing near. This means that Christ is, he's on the doorstep. He could come at any moment. But Jesus said, these things are not the signs. This is not the end. So the very things that people associate with the coming doom and destruction of the world, Jesus says we shouldn't do that. But what was the sign? What is the sign that Jesus said would indicate that the end was coming? He tells us that clearly in verse 15. He said, when you see the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, then he says, run for your lives. Run for the hills. Flee to the mountaintops. Don't go back to your house to gather your belongings. If you're out in the field, don't go get your coat. If it happens on the Sabbath day or in the winter or when you're pregnant, it's just going to be horrible for you at that time. It's just going to be the worst kind of tribulation. But he's given them a sign. When you see that abomination of desolation, then you run for it. You hightail it. Well, what was the abomination of desolation? Jesus said that we read about that in the book of Daniel, according to the prophet Daniel. Three places in the book of Daniel talk about the abomination of desolation. Daniel 9:27, 11:31, and 12:11. And what they associate with this abomination of desolation is the abolishing of the regular temple sacrifices. Let me ask you this. If the temple is destroyed to where not one stone is left upon another, don't you think that would take care of that? Don't you think that would end the daily offering of the sacrifices in the temple? And then in Daniel chapter 9, in verse 27, we read, and he will make a firm covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to the sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Not only is this associated with the ending of the temple sacrifices, but also the complete destruction of something. What is it? What are we talking about here? What is this abomination of desolation? The great thing is we're not left to wonder. We're not left to figure that out on our own. There's an inspired parallel passage that tells us clearly what that is. Luke 21 and verse 20, in the same setting, parallel account, Jesus said, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. This whole prophecy is a reference to the Roman army surrounding and destroying Jerusalem in 70 AD. Now, when we read that passage where it says, standing in the holy place, the abomination of desolation standing there in the holy place, a lot of people want to make that mean the holy place in the temple, the Holy of Holies, where the priest went once a year to make the sacrifice for the atonement of the sins of Israel. That's not necessarily what that's talking about. That word place is the Greek word topos. It's where we get our word topography. Anybody heard of a topographical map? It's a map of lands. It's a map of terrains. And this could very easily mean the holy land, not necessarily the holy place in the temple. So the sign is that the armies were going to be surrounding Jerusalem. And when you see that happening, you beat it. You get out of town, you head for the hills. That's what Jesus is telling those people gathered around him at that time, in that day. So the question is, why would Rome send armies to destroy Jerusalem? Why would they send armies to surround that city? Well, there was this thing called the Great Revolt that went on from 66 to 70 AD. And it was a Jewish uprising. And the Jews were just fed up with the Roman Empire and the way that they were treating them and their people. The Romans, they had contempt for the Jews. They made them pay extremely high, exorbitant taxes. They appointed the high priest, the Romans did, instead of allowing the Jews to do that themselves. Caligula, who was the emperor in 39 AD, he declared himself to be a god. And he demanded that every temple in the empire, that there would be a statue of himself erected in that temple. Obviously, the Jews were not happy about that. They were the last holdout. They refused to do that. There was a lot of Jewish unrest that led to a bitter civil war between the radicals and the moderates who lived in the city trying to figure out how best to deal with Rome. Jesus told his disciples there would be increased lawlessness at this time. There would be turmoil. There would be tribulation. Before the end came, this was it. This civil war that was going on between brothers, the Jewish brethren. This was that tribulation that led to the great tribulation. It was about to get worse, though. In 70 AD, General Titus was the commander of the Roman armies who laid siege to Jerusalem. He was the one sent to deal with the problem of the Jews. Now, in verses 15 through 20, we read there, Jesus said, when you see that abomination of desolation, when you see those armies surrounding that city, you run for your lives. There's a sense of urgency here. He tells them, look for your opportunity to get away. There's going to be a chance to do that, but it's going to be brief. You have to seize the moment. Do that before they have a chance to be entrenched around the city. Do that before they have a chance to be as organized as they're going to be. Now listen, verse 16, he says, those in Judea flee to the mountains. What would be the natural impulse for those in the outskirts in Judea, not in the city? What would be the natural impulse for them to do if they saw danger approaching? It would be to run to the city because that was a walled city. That was a protected city. Jesus said, don't do that because you're going to be trapped like rats if you go in there. You run for the hills. You run for the mountains. It's going to be safer for you up there. It's going to be harder for them to get you up there. Verses 17 and 18, he says, if you're on the rooftop, don't come down to get your belongings. You just have a few moments to make this decision. You see the sign, you get out of town. He said, if you're in the field, don't go back to get your clothes. It's not worth it. If you go back to the city to get your clothes, then you're a goner. You're a dead duck. Beat it out of town. Run for the hills. You got this brief opportunity, so get out while you can. And when the troops surrounded the city under Titus, that siege that they laid at Jerusalem, it lasted for 6 or 7 months. The first thing they did was they cut off any supplies that came into the city. They starved them to death. They isolated them. And eventually, they sacked the city. They ransacked it. They burned the temple and they destroyed it. Not one stone was left upon another. Total destruction. The Holy Land was destroyed. Jerusalem, it was destroyed. The holy place was obliterated. Josephus, a Jewish historian, wrote about the destruction, about the carnage of that incursion. Josephus wrote, now as soon as the army had no more people to slay or to plunder, because there remained none to be the objects of fury, Caesar gave orders that they should now demolish the entire city and temple. And Josephus estimated that 1 million Jews were destroyed in that carnage. So it was just a devastating thing. It was the end of Israel's nationhood. It was the end of the age. Now Jesus answers the first question that they asked. When would these things happen? Hundreds of years later? Thousands of years later in the time that we live? No. Jesus said in verse 34, this generation shall not pass until all these things come to pass. So he's telling them, the people standing there who live in that generation, it's going to happen in their lifetime. What's a generation? How long does a generation last? Some people say 20 years, 30 years. A safe assessment of what a generation is 40 years. It's very typically used as a duration of a generation. You think about it. Jesus spoke around 30 AD, and this destruction of Jerusalem happened 40 years later, around 40 years later in 70 AD. So the Lord's prophecy came true. It was fulfilled just like, of course it was going to be fulfilled, like all of his prophecies are fulfilled. It came true. And we can always count on the Lord if he says something's going to happen. Why did this have to happen to the Jews? Why did the Lord send the armies of Rome to destroy his very own people? Well, there's no mystery there either. He tells us clearly. You just back up one chapter to Matthew chapter 23 of what he says right before we read the contents of chapter 24. Starting in verse 34, he said, therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets, wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, so that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. The people there in Jerusalem living at that time. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together, the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate. For I say to you, from now on, you will not see me until I say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. The exact same kind of language. This was a prophecy for the destruction of Jerusalem. Their house was going to be left desolate. That generation wasn't going to pass until all these things happened. Not final judgment, but immediate judgment on these people. The people in the world today who are looking at this as a future prophecy yet to be fulfilled, there are so many problems associated with that. You have to make this a prophecy that has a double fulfillment. And I would ask simply, where's the evidence for that? There is none. You have to change many of the key words that are in this passage to make that fit. The pronoun you is used 20 times in Jesus' discourse there in Matthew chapter 24. Instead of you, it has to be changed to they. Who is the you he's talking to? He's talking to the people there. You people, not the people 2,000 years from now. So you has to be changed to they, to us. And this generation has to be changed to that generation. And the end of the age has to be changed to the end of the world. You can see it just doesn't fit if you look at this logically. Well, are there problems associated with the destruction of Jerusalem theory, the one that I just gave to you? Are there problems associated with the theory that I just presented to you? People will say there are. In verse 14, Jesus said, the gospel of the kingdom will have to be preached to the whole world first. And people say, see, the gospel hasn't been preached to the whole world yet. This is not going to happen until that takes place. Well, according to the Bible, the gospel had been preached to the whole world, even in the time of the apostles. Look at what is written in Colossians chapter 1, verses 4 through 6. Because of the hope laid up for you in heaven, of which you previously heard in the word of truth, the gospel which has come to you, just as it has in all the world also, as it continually is bearing fruit and increasing. You see that, according to the Apostle Paul, the gospel had been preached to the whole world already when he wrote that. Romans chapter 16 and verse 26 says that same thing. He said, he has made known to all the nations the gospel. So according to the Bible, it had at that time. Now that's an interesting word, that word world that Jesus used in verse 14. It can mean just the Roman Empire. You look in Luke chapter 2 and verse 1. It says that a census was taken of the whole world at that time. Did that mean every nation, every place on the entire earth? Of course it did not. It was talking about just the nations of the Roman Empire. So it does not necessarily mean the whole earth. What about the ones taken and the ones being left behind? A lot of people who look for this to be an end time prophecy said, well, that's talking about when Christ comes to rapture up the saved and the lost are going to be left on the earth. Well, I think they've got that backwards. I don't think it's the ones who are left behind who are in trouble. I think it's the ones who are left who are going to be safe, and the ones who are taken are going to be the ones who are going to be killed. I'll give you an example of that. During this siege, the Romans massacred so many Jews, and a lot of it was just indiscriminate. They used catapults and they used dart throwers to hurl these missiles over the wall. And two people could be standing side by side, and one would be killed and the other would be left unharmed. That's what I think that's talking about. One is left and one is taken. The one who's taken is actually killed, the way I see this passage. I think the left behind people have that backwards. Are there some problems with this theory that I have presented to you today? Of course there are. There are problems with any theory involving Matthew 24. You just cannot escape it. You're going to run into it. But the problems with making this an end time prophecy are just insurmountable. It's just no way it fits. What's the big deal? Why make a big ruckus over this? Well, the implications, they're very far reaching. First of all, just say clearly, premillennialism, a lot of people don't even know what that means. That just means the people who believe that Jesus Christ is going to come back and set up a kingdom and reign for 1,000 years on this earth. People who believe in that, premillennialism, I just got to tell you, that's not true. It's not what the Bible teaches. That whole Left Behind series of books and movies, it's just not the truth. Because it makes Jerusalem God's city. And it makes the Jews God's people. And that's just not the case anymore. Christians are God's people. There's neither Jew nor Greek, bond nor free. If you belong to Jesus, then you're in His kingdom. And He doesn't show special favor to the Jews anymore. It makes Christ's kingdom a physical kingdom. It makes our warfare physical warfare instead of spiritual, like it says in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 4. But look, the kingdom is spiritual and our warfare is spiritual. And when Christ comes back, He's not going to revert back to the inferior physical. He wouldn't do that. The spiritual is the supreme. The spiritual is the superb. Also, if we believe that Jesus is going to rapture some people up to heaven and leave some other folks down for 7 years, and then He's going to come back and set up the kingdom, that means that Jesus is going to take us out of heaven after He put us there. I got to tell you, Jesus would not do that to us. Jesus would not do that to us. Say, He's not going to give us a taste of heaven and then bring us back to the earth. I'm not coming back. When Jesus takes me home to heaven, I'm staying there forever. And there's not going to be anything left on earth to come back to anyway. When Jesus comes back, it's all over. When Jesus comes back, it's not to establish a kingdom. He already did that. He didn't fail. The prophets of old said He was going to establish it in the days of the Roman kings. He did. And when He comes back, listen, it's not to establish anything. It's to judge. It's to destroy everything and judge the just and the unjust. It's to separate the sheep from the goats and assign people their place for eternity. Are you ready for that? Are you ready to stand before God in judgment? Now's the time to make that right before it's too late and you're standing before Him unprepared. You can go ahead and pick up your songbooks. We're going to sing number 612. Give you an opportunity to obey the gospel this morning if you haven't done that. Sensationalists make Matthew chapter 24 about the destruction of the world. And Revelation, they make that entire book about the destruction of the world, the end time events. I believe Matthew 24 is about the destruction of Jerusalem. I think there's ample evidence to prove that. I believe most of the book of Revelation is about the destruction of Rome, the Roman Empire. And maybe the last chapter or two is about when Christ returns to destroy the world and judge the living and the dead. But when you think about that, what's said in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 1? The things which must shortly come to pass. From the very beginning of that book, John said these are things that are coming very soon. 2,000 years later? I don't think that's what he's talking about. But at the end of Revelation, I believe he is talking about judgment. And in Matthew 25, after Jesus talked about the things that he talked about in chapter 24, I believe he is talking about the judgment there as well. He ends his Olivet discourse with that great scene of the judgment, parting the sheep and the goats on the right and the left. We're going to talk about that tonight. If you have an opportunity to come back, I hope you do that. Talk about being prepared for that great day. Call that the Olivet discourse because that's when Jesus sat on the Mount of Olives and he told his disciples these things. But I hope you come back tonight to talk about the rest of that Olivet discourse. And if you are subject to the call of the gospel this morning, you're ready to obey that call, you're ready to be baptized to have your sins forgiven, we stand ready to help you this morning. You come up here and talk to me about those things while we're standing and singing to your encouragement.